On this week's program, Susan Lewis considers the 20th century Pennsylvania sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Esherick. In the midst of their busiest time of the year, Tom Keels spends time with some of Philadelphia's historical interpreters. David Patrick Stearns explores the growing international reputation of Baltic composers. And we speak with David Contosta and Carol Franklin, authors of Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City, Philadelphia's Wissahickon Valley, 1620 to 2020. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The pioneering 20th century sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Esherick lived and worked in Philadelphia and the surrounding countryside, where his one-time studio and home is now a museum. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the life and influence of this artist who practiced a variety of artistic disciplines before achieving fame for his curvilinear freeform sculpture.
25 miles west of Philadelphia, off the highways, beyond parkland and pastures, a road curves and climbs up a forested hill. At the top, nestled in the woods, is where artist Wharton Esherick lived and created the innovative forms, carved mostly from wood, that prompted his peers to call him the Dean of American Craftsmen and paved the way for the American studio furniture movement. Paul Eisenhower, curator of what is now the Wharton Esherick Museum, says prior to Esherick,
you had the traditional furniture maker copying traditional styles and doing beautiful reproduction kind of work. And then you had the industrial designers using industrial techniques and new methods and new materials, aluminum and plastics.
Esherick says Eisenhower took the best of those two worlds, bringing in his own background in arts and crafts and his love of the countryside.
And produced pieces like none that had ever been done before, and was using a traditional medium of wood to produce fine art, and not just fine art, but functional fine art.
The museum building itself, a stone farmhouse with wood and stucco additions, reflects Escherich's artistic evolution from the arts and crafts style through German Expressionism and beyond. Inside, nearly everything is crafted, from small light fixtures and coat hooks to large freestanding sculptures, like that of a couple entwined and a horse in motion, to his famous trapezoidal spiral staircase that appeared in the 1940 World's Fair. There are few, if any, right angles. Shapes appear to buckle and bend. Edges go this way and that, conjuring a whimsical world unto itself.
If you had to describe him, organic is the word. Flowing form that looks like it comes from nature. Nature rarely has right angles, and it rarely has straight or parallel lines.
So who was this sculptor of international acclaim who lived in the woods with a copy of Thoreau's Walden by his bedside? Bill Whitaker is curator of architectural archives at the University of Pennsylvania.
Our understanding of Esherick in some ways has been limited by seeing Esherick as a furniture maker. And he himself didn't see himself as a furniture maker. He saw himself as an artist.
Whitaker says Escherich's roots, the early friends, places, and passions he embraced, supported and nourished his growth into a pivotal figure in American modernism.
You have to push down into this earlier period of his life. You have to show this wide variety of art and work that he was exploring at the period to really see the brilliance of the later work.
Esherick was born in 1887 in Philadelphia, married a former classmate from high school, and moved out to the countryside. He set out to be an impressionist painter, but had a difficult time selling his work. Then came a trip to Fairhope, Alabama, where his wife wanted to study progressive education. It was here, says Lynn Farrington, curator of printed books at Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, that Esherick began carving frames for his paintings.
People are more interested in the frames he's carved than the pictures he's painted. He then starts making wood engravings and woodblock prints and discovers that he has an interest, he enjoys it. Then gradually moves into other things as well. He moves into furniture, he's starting to play with angles, he's starting to explore different ways of expressing himself.
While Esherick lived in the Philadelphia area, his work was informed by other travels as well, including trips to New York City and the Adirondacks, where he participated in dance camps. He became friends with prominent writers Sherwood Anderson and Theodore Dreiser, as well as Harold Mason, owner of Center City Philadelphia's gathering place for artists, the Centaur Bookstore, which published his woodcut illustrations in books by Walt Whitman and D.H. Lawrence, among others. A lover of dance and music, his first sculptures included dancers and a firebird. He attended the Philadelphia Orchestra, getting to know concertmaster Alexander Hillsburg and later board member Curtis Bach. He was also very involved in Hedgerow Theater. Hedgerow's artistic director Penelope Reed says founder Jasper Dieter and Escherich became fast friends.
And he did artwork, graphics, sets. We have a beautiful Escherich table that he built for the actors to eat at. And we have the hammer-handled chairs, axe-handled chairs. And he gave them as payment for acting classes for his daughter.
Escherich made hundreds and hundreds of sketches of performances at Hedgerow. But he actually drew everywhere, Eisenhower says, using his pencil the way most people would a camera.
So you get this kind of travelogue, looking through his sketches of the places he's going and his friends and what they're doing and seeing.
Escherich played artistically with what we'd call today found objects, making chairs like the ones from Hedgerow from hammer handles. He also turned leftover circular wood shapes from a wheel maker into wagon wheel chairs.
And each chair was different, and each chair evolved over time into a more complex form that then results in a suite of furniture that he does for the World's Fair in 1940.
He also did high-profile commissions. One of his principal patrons was Philadelphia Orchestra board member Curtis Bach, for whom he designed a house, a fireplace mantle from which is in the Philadelphia Museum of Art's permanent collection. With the completion of the Bach House in the late 30s, Wharton Escherich was developing his own curvaceous style and finally making a national and international name for himself as an artist for whom modernism didn't have to mean metallic or industrial materials, and a furniture maker who crafted commonplace objects in uncommon ways.
Like Cézanne, he taught people to see differently. Sculptors started thinking about furniture and other functional items differently, and people who made functional items started thinking about them differently as well. So it was really bridging that gap between art and craft.
Like his art, Wharton Escherich himself defies easy definition, embracing music and dance, theater and books. Escherich liked the shore and the mountains, Alabama and New York City, always coming home to a wooded hillside in rural Pennsylvania. An artist who loved to make art and then use it.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Wharton Escherich Museum in Paoli, Pennsylvania conducts guided tours by reservation year-round.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
As Philadelphia's tourist season reaches its peak each summer, Independence National Historic Park swarms with men and women dressed in colonial costume. Don't call them reenactors, though. These are historical interpreters who bring the 18th century back to life by taking on the personae of famous founding fathers or plain old Philadelphians. Now WRTI's Tom Keels reveals some of the tricks of the trade of the historical interpreter.
And someone would usually propose a toast. This was a big tradition at the time, and the toasts would get lively, and after everyone had put their toast together, whoever had proposed it would say hip hip, and everyone else would reply with huzzah. This may happen on our tour tonight. I want everyone to be prepared in case it does, so we're going to try it now. Hip hip!
Huzzah!
It's a muggy June evening, and a tour group for the Independence After Hours program is standing near the corner of Chestnut and Fifth, across from Independence Hall. Suddenly, an agitated man in knee breeches and a tricorn hat approaches. He introduces himself as John Dunlap, printer to the Continental Congress and a founding member of the First City Troop.
So I print everything that comes out of Congress, and I'm ever ready to fight for our freedom.
On this night, which Dunlap names as July 4th, 1776, he is searching for one particular congressional delegate.
But now I must find Mr. Jefferson. I have just received orders from Congress about an important printing job, and I must start setting the type for it immediately.
Over dinner at the city tavern, we encounter Thomas Jefferson, who is dismayed by the last-minute changes Congress has made to his Declaration of Independence. After dinner, we follow our guide to Independence Hall, where Jefferson reads his revolutionary document to a rapt Ben Franklin and John Adams.
We hold these truths to be
self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
These founding fathers are only a few of the 30 to 40 actors employed by Historic Philadelphia Incorporated, the nonprofit organization which runs Independence After Hours, Once Upon a Nation, and other tours in the historic district. Jennifer Hoffmaster is programming manager at Historic Philadelphia.
Here we call them interpreters, and I know within that you can say there's first person, there's second person, and third person interpretation. Here they are first person interpreters, and when you speak to them, they will speak as that person would speak to you. So they are in that time frame, and they're not supposed to come out of it.
A second person interpreter is also a historical character, but one looking over his entire life like a ghost. A third-person interpreter does not portray a character, but dresses in costume to tell stories or teach about history. Historic Philadelphia's interpreters come from many different backgrounds, theater, academia, business, but all receive over 100 hours of training at a special school named, in honor of Ben Franklin, the Benstitute. There, they learn the basics of not only history and storytelling, but customer service and geography.
The actors do a lot of research on their own, especially if they want to portray famous figures such as Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson.
Only a select handful of interpreters portray famous characters like Ben Franklin or Betsy Ross. As Independence Day approaches, the demand for their services grows intense. Sometimes tourists might think they're seeing double, especially in the case of Benjamin Franklin. The venerable Ralph Archbold has portrayed this favorite Philadelphian for decades, but he faces stiff competition from Bill Ochester, who appears as Franklin in Historic Philadelphia tours.
They were looking for a middle-aged Franklin in order to do a press conference. I walked in, my supervisor saw me, and she just dragged me down to the meeting, literally shoved me into the meeting and said, "Look what I found."
Once Independence After Hours has ended, Bill Ochester and his colleague Steve Edenbow, who portrays Jefferson, repair to the City Tavern. Ochester, who is retired from the medical profession, has portrayed Benjamin Franklin since 2004. He also reenacts Revolutionary War battles with the 4th Continental Light Dragoons. Edenbow, a graduate of Dickinson College with theatrical experience, has portrayed Jefferson since 1999. As they order dinner at the tavern, both men are still in costume and in character.
How big is that salmon trout for you?
It's essentially meant for one person. Your big dad, your big man, Dr. Franklin.
All right. Well,
if I were here with, say, Mrs. Jefferson, it would be enough for two.
Ochester and Edenbow rank among the stars of local interpreters. Besides their work with Historic Philadelphia, both men make numerous appearances as Franklin and Jefferson at corporate, school, and private functions. While a novice interpreter with Historic Philadelphia earns $13 an hour, Ochester and Edenbow can command hundreds of dollars for their appearances. Edenbow is able to earn a full-time living portraying Jefferson.
I'm not going to recommend it to anybody. It's not a viable career in a sensible kind of way. You never hear a mom say to her little girl, "Oh, honey, I hope you grow up someday and marry a nice Thomas Jefferson interpreter so you can take care of me in my old age." It doesn't happen. But you have to follow your passion.
Both Ochester and Edenbow have studied their characters extensively. Edenbow finds that an encyclopedic knowledge of Jefferson's accomplishments is necessary so that he can portray him either at a specific moment in time or as an omniscient ghost.
This morning I was Secretary of State Jefferson and Presidential Jefferson. Last night I had to be, I call it a timeless performance, where I'm sort of the alabaster bust. I know his whole life. I have to be very dignified, very, very under control, a good public speaker. And with this performance, I get to be Hugh Grant as Thomas Jefferson, the bumbling, kind of lovable, but uncomfortable in public, but brilliant, sort of charming individual. And that's, so I get to be three different Jeffersons in the course of 24 hours.
Just like an actor preparing for a stage or screen appearance, Ochester sees a constant study of Ben Franklin as essential to giving a commanding performance. That's the only way to hold the attention of schoolchildren jaded by modern technology, or tourists exhausted by the hot Philadelphia summer.
Franklin is a massive character. I mean, you really need to know a little bit about everything and a lot about some things, and all my reading and everything sort of centers around Franklin now. our greatest thrill is if we speak to someone and they respond to us as they would to Mr. Jefferson or Mr. Franklin. That is the greatest compliment that we can get.
Based on the reactions of passersby, both Ochester and Edenbow succeed brilliantly. Strangers yell hello, ask questions, and want to have their pictures taken with them. While Franklin and Jefferson might not be in the same league as Chase Utley or Ryan Howard, they still seem to have as many groupies today as they had in that steamy summer of 1776.
WRTI's Tom Keels. While both Bill Ochester and Steve Edenbow will be celebrating the 4th of July in Washington, D.C. this year, their fellow interpreters will be out in full force at Independence National Historic Park on Monday, telling stories, leading tours, and teaching visitors about the birth of America. The future of classical music, or at least a part of it, is coming from some unlikely places, the Baltic Republics. Beyond the hypnotic sacred music of the Estonian Arvo Pärt, increasingly fantastical pieces have been appearing on Philadelphia concert programs from Baltic composers with even more unpronounceable names. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns went to the celebrated Nargen Festival in Estonia to see if these Baltic composers are all they seem to be. And in Tallinn, Riga, and even on an island out in the Baltic Sea, he discovered a multitude of dedicated composers.
Could anybody have guessed, in this performance of Velio Tormius' Autumn Landscape by the Temple University Concert Choir, what lay behind this strange, entrancing music? Certainly, I never foresaw traveling to the near-deserted island of Naissaar, a 45-minute ferry ride from the Estonian capital of Tallinn, for a festival celebrating Tormius' 80th birthday. Though fellow Estonian Arvo Pärt is more famous, his brand of holy minimalism, the genre he created, is a musical law unto himself. The key to understanding the sensibility and imagination of so many other Estonian composers was more likely to be heard in Tormius, who is considered a hero as well as an artist. His concerts are held in places laden with larger meaning, an abandoned munitions factory, or a one-time Soviet stronghold on the island of Naissaar. In effect, music takes root on previously scorched earth. On Naissaar, as we ride a motorized cart along the unpaved roads between the boat dock and the concert hall, Estonian musicologist Hervé Lippus explains the presence of diffused landmines, rusty Soviet machinery, and a crumbling Swedish church along the way.
Well, it has history until 1940, because this was inhabited by Estonian Swedes. They were farming and fishing men living here. But as they were Swedes, they got the possibility to flee to Sweden before the Soviets came.
Upon arrival on the highest point of the island, once a lookout point to view approaching ships, I meet the lean, energetic Tormius, nicely recovered from a heart attack but still sneaking cigarettes. Lippus was our interpreter.
Velio is proposing to talk at once?
Sure.
When a young man, Tormius had a bright future in Russia. Dmitri Shostakovich was among his champions when he took a less prestigious left turn, devoting the rest of his life to folk-based choral music. The music was sung, among other places, in massive Estonian song festivals, where the residents of this country of 1.5 million people no longer felt so tiny next to the massive Soviet Union. Slowly, over time, these festivals were such a nationalistic flashpoint that Estonian independence is said to have come out of the singing revolution. Tormius' music was an important part of that, even if he credits other musicians with having greater influence.
In 1969, when Velio wrote the cantata for the General Song Festival, that probably had some effect. He doesn't feel that he helped to bring about the singing revolution. Actually, singing revolution took place in other musical genres. That was more in pop and rock and...
Punk.
Punk.
Punk, yeah.
Over the years, however, What passed for folk-based music, in fact, reflected the long-simmering rage against repression. Tormius's music from the 1970s was particularly angry.
That's true, but then there was something against what to be angry. And that lasted into the 80s.
Historically, Estonian painting and music tended to be a Me Too version of art created in more cosmopolitan places. But when the Soviet imposed isolation ended, composers started cherry-picking outside influences and putting them together in their own distinctively rugged fashion. The acclaimed Estonian composer Erki Sventur lives on an island not unlike Naissaar, but takes his creative cues from the power of nature.
You are in a connection with something which is so much older and bigger than we are here in this planet. And I think it plays a role. It's not that I'm painting the nature with sounds. I'm not at all. But I think that this environment helps me with a great deal to concentrate on my work and to get the energy for it.
More startling are the choral works coming out of the Baltic states. Early in 2010, Donald Nelly's group The Crossing sang a piece titled Sundogs from a young Latvian composer that nobody had even begun to hear about. Eriks Esenvalds didn't even have much of a bio except for the fact that he had taught high school. Nelly discovered him almost by chance.
Some person at a concert here, she came to listen to us and she said, "Oh my God, your choir would love this Latvian friend of mine. He writes this new music." And I'm like, "Oh, well, you should give me a CD. I'll listen to it, or give me a score, you know." And the next thing I knew, I had like programmed it for January.
Though American choirs have, until recently, stayed close to conservative idioms, Esenvalds explained in a noisy cafeteria in Riga that Latvian choirs welcome being pushed to their limits.
We have been encouraged to search new ways in writing for choir. And we have added whispering, breathing, whistling, additional instruments. So I would call that process the choir to become also an orchestra.
Not all Latvian composers are so thoughtful. Lest we unduly idealize them, the Latvian State Choir, on the day I visited, was rehearsing a kitschy pop choral fusion. Leonard Bernstein had been there and done that 35 years ago. But as one composer said, the Baltic republics did not do it 35 years ago and must get it out of their system somehow. For all their stubborn independence, the Baltic composers are moving towards the classical mainstream. When Esenvalds writes a choral work, it's often in English to enhance his performance prospects. Vocal-only composers are now embracing the orchestra. Arvo Pärt's Symphony No. 4, his first work in that medium for many decades, is not on the ECM label. Even Tormis, at this late date, enters a new phase with instrumental transcriptions of his choral works that should bring his music to a much wider audience. But the pieces sound nothing like the busy, descriptive overtures he wrote before his choral conversion. By no means is the singing revolution forgotten. It runs underneath everything like subterranean spring water. Some Baltic orchestra conductors are so vocally accomplished they could fill in for an indisposed opera singer. No matter what direction new compositions go, even in the gargantuan symphonic canvases of Erki Sventur, this music is anchored in the human voice. Maybe Baltic composers are able to fly so high because their roots are so simple, deep, and found everywhere around them.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Wissahickon Valley, a northwestern section of Philadelphia's great sprawling Fairmount Park system, has been pivotal in the history of America and for centuries a source of inspiration for artists. This 9-mile-long, densely forested gorge has been the subject of paintings, music and literature for centuries. Today, though still beautiful, the Wissahickon is in a state of flux. Its water is polluted, its native plants struggle to survive, and decades of bureaucratic apathy have left the care of the gorge to voluntary organizations. The history of the river's lower valley, the Wissahickon Gorge, and the middle valley, the Meadowlands, directly beyond Philadelphia, are told in David Contosta and Carol Franklin's Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City. It's a compendium divided into four volumes, Wilderness, Park, Valley, and Corridor, each approximately chronological, but also reflecting how different socio-political, economic, artistic, and ecological trends have impacted the past, present, and even future of the Wissahickon. Let's cover the pre-park era. Wissahickon, the name means Yellow River?
Well, it's a conflation of two different words, one of which means yellow-colored stream and the other catfish stream, and it seems to be a conflation of the two. It's a Lenape word.
Carol, the area we now know as the Wissahickon Gorge, the park area, is a tree-lined gorge. Ecologically, how was it pre-park?
There is a lot of discussion of how very different the forest was then, both because of missing animals, like the passenger pigeon that flew in their billions over Philadelphia. And the other thing is the missing trees, such as the chestnut tree, which died in the blight starting in 1904.
So when you say missing, you mean those trees and plants existed pre-forest, but they're not there
today,
right?
Yes, it was a very different looking forest. The hills were white with chestnut blossoms and yellow with the color of chestnuts in the fall. And they formed at least a fourth of the forest.
The development of the area as a park was related to protecting the watershed so that Fairmount Park Waterworks would work.
Yes, right? It was related to several things. There was an intake just below where the Wissahickon went into the Schuylkill. And, of course, the city of Philadelphia began creating parkland along the Schuylkill to protect the water supply and then the Wissahickon. But Frederick Law Olmsted came down here from New York and advised the Fairmount Park Commission in 1867 that they ought to begin taking the Wissahickon, not only for hygienic purposes in the water supply, but also because of its wildness and because it would make for wonderful carriage drives and recreation. So it's a dual purpose. It's recreation as well as to safeguard the water supply.
The main thoroughfare that runs through the Wissahickon Gorge, called Forbidden Drive, were motor vehicles always forbidden there?
They were not at first. Cars started showing up in Fairmount Park in the late 1890s, and then people wanted to drive up the Wissahickon to Mount Airy and Chestnut Hill, and they kept applying to the Fairmount Park Commission for permission. This would have resulted in widening the road and cutting down some of the hillsides. The mayor of Philadelphia, I believe, in 1920, said that if people really were sincere in trying to keep cars out, they should have an equestrian demonstration, which they did in October of 1920. They rode their carriages and their horses. Then Fairmount Park Commission forbade cars, and that's why the road is called Forbidden Drive.
David Contosta and Carol Franklin, authors of Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City, Philadelphia's Wissahickon Valley, 1620 to 2020. Out now on St. Joseph's University Press. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.